Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. Amelia Mellor's first published novel, The Grandest Bookshop in the World, won an Australian Book Industry Award, an Indie Book Award, a New South Wales Premier's Literary Award, a Booksellers' Choice Award, and was shortlisted for the 2021 ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category. But in 2023, her novel, The Booksellers' Apprentice, won the ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category. It's a great pleasure to welcome her today to Imagining the Past.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm very well. And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, The Grandest Bookshop in the World was shortlisted for the 2021 ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category, and that was your first published novel. The Bookseller's Apprentice is a prequel to The Grandest Bookshop in the World. Your characters seem to be kind of growing younger, like Billy does. How did that come about to write the prequel?
I was revising The Grandest Bookshop in the World, and I was looking over my research notes, and Paddy's Market, which is where Edward William Cole's book arcade and book selling, it eventually became a bit of an empire. That was where that began, Paddy's Market in Melbourne, which was also called the Eastern Market and eventually became part of the Queen Victoria Market. And when I was going back through my research and reading about this place and just checking my facts, I got a bit distracted by the market. I was amazed at what an interesting place it seemed. And just like Cole's Book Arcade, which was the setting of the first book, it seemed like a really lively and interesting place that was mostly forgotten in our cultural consciousness. And I thought it was really interesting that it was sort of a cultural meeting place and a place for, the less powerful classes to meet. It was because there were protests there, and it was, this is a little off track, but many Australian cities and towns are planned without a plaza or like a town square. And this was actually very deliberate during colonial times. All through the 19th century, there's this attitude in the British Empire of terror of the French Revolution happening to them. And a lot of changes were made during that time in response to that. And one of those things that happened was Australian towns were planned without a town square so that, you know, the people couldn't gather and form a revolution. In the case of Paddy's Market, it actually backfired, and that became the cultural meeting place about 300 metres from Parliament House. So it interested me that it was this place, you know, where people had the power to resist, where people met different cultures, and also that, like Cole's Book Arcade, was almost unbelievably weird. And Yeah, I was. So the setting grabbed me first, and then when I was trying to learn a little bit more about Cole's past, I ended up sort of forming a bit of an attachment to William Pike. I thought what first got me interested in him was that he was sort of the grounded one compared to Cole, the visionary. And so I liked that dynamic, and I looked into more about them, and I just couldn't resist it. I thought, look, it will go back in time. It will be a prequel, and people will go, which one do you read first? But I thought it was really interesting. I wanted to explore the dynamic. I wanted to explore the setting. And I ended up finding out about so many things that I think really made the story worth telling.
But at what stage of the first novel did this process start? Had you finished the first novel? Was the first novel published, or was it, you know, had you handed it in to the publisher? What I'm trying to get at was, how fixed was the first novel when you started to write the prequel, and how did that govern, having this kind of fixed text, govern you writing the prequel?
Oh, I see. I was planning it while I was revising The Grandest Bookshop in the World. However, I didn't actually start writing it until Grandest had gone to print. So there were some things that were fixed.
Yeah.
But by the time I got to the end of Apprentice, I was like, I have to figure out a way. That makes sense. Otherwise, though, there weren't many things where I thought, you know, how can this make sense? And in a way, you know, I was able to have a bit of fun too. There's a moment in Apprentice in which Mr. Cole says, oh, I'd love to have a big bookshop one day. And, you know, there are other little connections like that. So I did build those in, but I didn't really plan for it to be a series. All the way through writing The Grandest Bookshop in the World, I thought, I wonder what other stories I could tell from this. But I suppose it is funny that it ended up being a prequel.
I don't mean to imply that. I just think it must come with a certain set of conditions, you know, that you've started at this point and you have to go back. So in some ways, I think creatively having some, you know, for want of a better word, roadblocks that you have to use creatively, I find that really inspiring, that you just have to really put your mind to it and find ways around, you know, these obstacles.
Oh, thank you. One thing that made it much easier in this case was that there are not many of the same characters. It's 22 years before. The children from the first book aren't born yet. Their mum hasn't even met their dad. So that made it very easy in terms of the continuity, the fact that we don't have too many of the same people.
And did that make it easier to make The Apprentice a standalone as well? Because I always think that's one of the difficulties with a series is, do you make them standalone, or do you just throw that out and just make the reader go from number one to wherever you finish?
This was something that I sort of discussed with my editors, how much the books would rely on each other. But I mean, I think that's the nice thing about Apprentice. It did end up being readable as a standalone. I think it's more rewarding to read Grandest first and then Apprentice. But yeah, it was, I certainly planned it knowing that, I planned it knowing that there'd be a series after I'd already delivered the first one, but I'd planned it with the intention that, to me, I was creating a series, but I also knew that it wouldn't be necessarily read as one, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I'm almost finished the third one now as well. And that's been a little more difficult, but I'm informed that I've managed to do it a third time. So
okay, maybe we can chat about that a bit later. But what was the first idea you had for all of the novels? Like, where did, you know, the interest in Edward Cole come from, and how did all that start?
Oh, it was, I was at my friend's house. I was 24. I had just recently got another manuscript rejected because I actually wrote two books before The Grandest Bookshop in the World that still have never been published.
Were they CYA?
They were. One was sort of upper middle grade, but not really in any good age category. It sort of didn't fit anywhere. And the other one was definitely YA. But yeah, I racked up more than 40 rejections for those two. And one of them I got just at acquisitions. I was about to sort of give up on publishing altogether. And I was at my friend's house and she greeted me at the door with, "Have you heard of Cole's Book Arcade?" And I had not. And she told me all about it. She had this wonderful Cole's Funny Picture Book, which was an antique. Edward Cole was, for those who may not know, a children's author as well as a bookseller. She was telling me about Cole's Book Arcade. She was telling me about Mr. Cole. And I couldn't believe that it was real, but I was also thrilled that it was. And I said, "This is an amazing idea for a middle grade book." And she said, "Well, you're a writer, aren't you?" And I had sort of started thinking, well, maybe I can't be. But when she said that, I was like, yeah, I could give it a go. When she even read out the advertisement for Cole's Book Arcade from 1883, which was the day that the big one opened, because, you know, there were more than one in different places and stuff, but the big one in 1883 opened with this ad in the newspapers. It said, "Cole's new book arcade will open on Cup Day," being Melbourne Cup Day. "It is the finest site in Melbourne and the greatest bookshop in the world. Intellectual, non-racing people are invited there instead of going to the races." And when she read that out, I was like, "The Grandest Bookshop in the World is an incredible title." Anyway, we went to the museum together the next week and sort of looked at the original site. But my imagination was really set alight when I found out that there was, in fact, a cult family.
Yeah.
And finding the children that have been attached to the Cole's Book Arcade story really gave me my series.
Mm. They're wonderful, those moments, those serendipitous moments where you, if you'd walked it in a different direction, you know, you might not have responded or just been in a different mood that day. Or if you'd had something to tell your friend, which overrode what she had to tell you, then it's funny to kind of think about those things. I'm always interested in writers' kind of process, how they approach the whole thing. So could you tell us a bit about your first draft? Do you plan it or do you just kind of wing it?
Well, I plan it like someone plans a trek through unexplored territory. You think you know where you're going and you can sort of see the shape of the mountain ahead of you. But once you're on the ground, sometimes it's a bit of a different story. So I tend to lay out a pretty detailed plan when I start. And then about halfway through, I get better ideas or I find that something doesn't work. Sometimes I get more than halfway through and find that it doesn't work. So, yeah, I make plans. I don't really stick to them as much as I imagine that I will. There were other possibilities for different, you know, scenes and challenges that have arisen throughout this series. In The Bookseller's Apprentice in particular, there were a lot of things that I imagined would be great that I just did not have room for. For instance, there was a character called Charlie the Tattoo Man who was referenced in my primary sources, but who I wasn't able to find out much about. So I wasn't sure if this was like a tattoo artist or like somebody exhibiting themselves. There were lots of stalls in Paddy's Market that I could have used and didn't end up using. So I definitely make big plans when I begin, but then once I'm actually underway, you know,
I don't need all
of those pieces necessarily.
It's like an organic process that they both start to feed off one another. I used to feel that I always had to have like a beginning, a middle, and an end in my head before I could start writing, and whether I stuck to that was another thing, but just having that kind of structure. It was one of the things I liked about historical fiction, was that you kind of had the historical ladder in place before you kind of started. So do you like first drafting?
I hate it.
Good.
I hate making things up from scratch. I like coming up with ideas, but I don't like having to figure out how to put them on paper. I much prefer rewriting.
Mm.
First drafting, to continue my analogy of exploring a mountain, first drafting is like, you know, wading through the jungle with a machete. And sometimes you find you've been going in the wrong direction for 10 kilometers.
Mm. But at least you've got a path back.
I find first drafting very frustrating. There are times when it's fun, but I have most of my fun on second and third drafts, really.
So when you're first drafting, how many words do you aim for in a session when you are writing, or do you not have that? Do you just write whatever you can that day?
I feel good if I've got at least 600 words down.
Which sounds not very much, but if you do it every day.
Exactly.
It just builds up. And I think that's one of the things people feel overcome. I mean, sitting down to write a novel is ridiculous. Like, you're sitting down to write 80,000 words. It's just absolutely crazy. But if you do it, if you break it down into small sections, as small as 500 or 600 words, it just builds up.
Yeah, and some days I'd certainly get more than that, but...
The good days. Yeah.
I feel good if I've got 600. I am quite slow, and I know there's certain people who aim for 2,000 a day or something, but I try to be very deliberate when I put it down, because getting it right is important to me.
Mm.
There may not be an objective right, but I mean, a first draft is kind of like a structural sketch in a way. I draw a little bit for a hobby, and I don't know. I feel like I have to get the sketch right, or the final version won't be as good.
Yeah, well, you need a good structure.
So I do go fairly slowly, but even. You know, if I get 600 words a day for 5 days in a row, that's a chapter a week.
Mm. Yeah, which is great. But once you've started drafting, do you continue in that, like I'd call it first gear mode, where you're just going along slowly? Do you continue in that mode until you get to the end, or do you kind of crop rotate and go back and start on some of the other earlier chapters to start to rework them? Or do you like to get a complete draft down before you start rewriting?
I wish I could get a complete draft down before I start rewriting, but I constantly rewrite as I go. Particularly if I get a really good idea for a plot point later in the story, I have to go back and... foreshadow it or weave it in earlier. Yeah. I just can't go start to finish, I'm afraid. God knows I'd make my deadlines quicker if I did, but I do constantly revise as I go. And as a result, usually the last part I write is near the end. So that sense of panic that my characters have in the climax is coming directly from me.
I felt it. So when you're redrafting, do you, I mean, you've kind of spoken about this a bit, but just you know, I always think those great surprises that just kind of like a character will just flop onto your page fully formed out of nowhere. Do those kinds of things happen to you? And if so, were there some in the novels here?
Yes, there certainly were some of those ideas. Characters from the first draft actually ended up being chopped. There was, in the very first draft of the Bookseller's Apprentice, there was a bunch of kids. They were a young pigeon fanciers club, because one of the things that happened in the real Paddy's Market was that on Friday nights, kids, mostly boys, would be trading fancy pigeons. The Victorians had a big obsession with fancy pigeons. Charles Darwin loved fancy pigeons. And in fact, they helped him figure out natural selection because fancy pigeons were an example of artificial selection. Mm. But this young pigeon fanciers club ended up getting cut. What stayed were the pigeons. Specifically, I decided, well, with my wonderful editor Meg's help, we decided that the Obscure Smith, the villainous magician in the story, would have some pigeon spies. And I was about halfway through writing the second draft of the Bookseller's Apprentice when I was like, wait a minute, what if the pigeons are people? And I'm like this absolutely bananas thing wherein a pigeon turns into a woman but still thinks she's a pigeon. And I know it was really weird, but I really liked it. That was one of those surprises.
Mm.
And
I'll never look at a pigeon the same again.
Oh, people have been telling me that. Especially if they see a feral pigeon that happens to be coloured a little bit like Justine, who's black and white. Yeah, that one came right the hell out of left field. But I was really thrilled that it did.
I've been thinking a lot about naming kind of lately. I kind of miss the telephone directory because you used to be able to sit there and read for names. But you've used names, I think, the device of naming to great purpose. I mean, a character like the Obscura Smith that you mentioned is, you know, like the use even of the word smith, it's like a wordsmith or a blacksmith, or so he's, you know, forging obscurity, which is a great kind of illusion for an illusionist. So how much time do you put into naming your characters? Because I really think it's something that a lot of writers forget about, the power of it.
Sometimes they get handed to me. I was pretty delighted, you know, that history handed me the name William Pike. You know, as I said in the book, Pike alluding to a soldier's spear and William coming from Wilhelm meaning helmet. So I really like that his name is Helmet and Spear. And I had to put it in through his friend Kezia, but I didn't make that up. That was just handed to me. A lot of the names were just handed to me, but other times I do make them up. A lot of the time I actually am more focused on how things sound than what they mean. For instance, the real great American painless dentist, the medicine showman who appears in the Bookseller's Apprentice, I never found out what his actual name was, just his title, which is as it is in the book. So I decided to call him Phineas Crane, but I picked that based on the sound. I wanted, you know, certain sibilants and certain, you know, harder sound and softer sounds, and I wanted something that sounded specifically like folksy American, a name like Phineas. I do that a lot.
Wasn't Phineas in a character in, was it Titty Titty Bang Bang or something?
There's a Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
But there's lots of those sort of.
Phineas is a great name.
It is. It's, yeah. So sometimes I do think very carefully about about what the names mean, like when I was figuring out the title Obscura Smith. But for instance, when I chose his Well, it's not his real name. He's, you know, he's a bit of an identity chameleon, the obscure Smith. But when I chose the name Magnus Macmillan for him, I was thinking along the lines of, you know, words like magnificent and magnification and sort of grandiose, sort of vaguely Latin sort of names. Something that I think is really valuable for writers to do if they're crafting names or, in fact, if they're writing fantasy or sci-fi. I think studying linguistics as part of my arts degree actually was amazing. It teaches you so much about language and how to look at language and how to choose the right word and the right sound for the right sentence and the right word for the right new concept and the right name for the right character. So that certainly comes, I mean, I hardly remember much of my linguistic studies, but the stuff that stuck has been really helpful.
So are you conscious when you're redrafting of entertaining your reader and engaging them?
Yes, certainly. In fact, with this series, I was conscious of it from the moment that I had that conversation with my friend. When she was describing Cole's book, Arcade, I specifically thought it was a really great idea for a kid's book, because I had played with teen fiction and stuff like that. And I'm not actually the first person to write fiction set in Cole's book, Arcade. There's also a novel for adults, Utopian Man by Lisa Lang, and that's pretty different from mine. It's, you know, it's aimed at adults, it's realistic, it's literary fiction, mine is kids fiction and fantasy at that. I am conscious of what kids are going to like, and from the beginning of the concept here, one of the reasons that I chose to focus on the children in and around Cole's book Arcade is that I knew from the start kids like to read about kids. Yes, Mr. Cole was very fascinating, but kids like to read about kids more than anything. And I knew from the beginning I was going to focus the concept on kids and what they like and what they thought would be fun. I'm pretty conscious of entertaining the kids as I go. I am also trying to entertain myself because I do still feel like a big kid some of the time. Sometimes I get carried away and I use a word that most kids won't know because I forget that not every kid was me and a big word nerd. And once or twice I have written something that's a bit too spooky and my editors have to pull me up.
Right.
But I am trying to entertain kids, and certainly when I go and visit schools or I see kids at a writer's festival, I feel like I've succeeded.
I guess, you know, what do you think is particular about CYA writing, and do you feel like there's some kind of pedagogical responsibility in this writing? You've kind of touched on that a bit.
I think your only responsibility I do think children's writers are like teachers, but I don't think you necessarily need to teach them a lesson. I'm certainly happy that kids are reading about history and getting interested in history from my books, but I think the only pedagogical responsibility you have is in the teaching of values, and, you know, that you're expressing ideas that promote inclusion and, you know, kindness in general. I don't think, you know, you always have to be striving to teach them an overt moral or trying to educate them about a particular topic. I think there's room for all kinds of stories as long as responsibility is a good word. And as long as you're telling those stories responsibly, obviously people have different ideas of which of those values are important, but to use an example, in my case, I'd like to include contemporary values because I don't want to, you know, perpetuate what the Victorians thought about women or, you know, any of those other sorts of things. So, yeah, I think that what you should be teaching them, you don't need to worry about it too much as long as you're modelling kindness, really.
I was thinking more at the level of the actual language as well because, you know, this is where we learn language. I mean, you did use some words like you used the word expeditiously, which I kind of, you know, stopped on when I read that. And I just kind of thought, wow, I wonder if, and you, the story of, I'm not sure of my pronunciation, but Julie Daubigny, the sword French sword fighter. Like, I thought they were kind of pretty out there. I just kind of was wondering how I would have responded to that if I'd read it as a child. But I just going back to my point about the grammar and the language, you know, and the use and the love of language, because, you know, I find a lot of books that are written, particularly for CYA in present tense, it's kind of like I feel like the authors usurp their responsibility to teach the reader how to use irregular verbs, you know, like on public transport, I continually hear the verb to come slaughtered, you know, and I just kind of think in present tense writing, which is how so many people speak now in present tense, it, you know, those verbs, those irregular verbs, which to me were always the building block and the sonically, the most exciting part of language when you have an irregular verb. You know, because it's put in there to pepper up the language and make it interesting. So that was kind of the level I was wondering how you feel about, you know, making children love words and actually see what words can do.
Well, I've always liked to use the right word for what I think is the right context. And even as a kid, you know, other kids would say, why do you use such big words? And I go, because they're the right words. And then when I was a teenager, people would go, Amelia, you swore. And I said, yeah, because this is the right time to swear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I try not to be too strict about how language is changing because it's always going to do that. People lamented the death of thou and thee, and that didn't particularly like the way that, one from the turn of the century, the word fix. Fix never used to mean mend, and people are always going to lament changes in language. I try to view them neutrally, but also I like to use complicated words if they're the right words. I'm not conscious of teaching kids when I do that. I'm just trying to use, you know, the right unit for what I mean to express. You know, that certainly does lock my books out to certain readers, which I am aware of. My next series is going to be a bit friendlier to, you know, some of those younger kids or kids who maybe reading isn't their forte. But yeah, no, I'm not trying to, I mean, I used to be a teacher, but I'm not conscious of trying to teach vocabulary. I just like to use my vocabulary, really.
No, I think one of the things you did really well was, you know, what I was alluding to was just showing what language can do. You know, it's language just isn't this thing that we string a sentence together to make a meaning. It's entertaining, you know, and I know of the people in my life, particularly my early life, who entertained me solely with language, just the way they used language. So why did you choose to write CYA and in particular CYA historical fiction? And do you think you'll ever write an adult fiction?
It just depends on whether the idea fits a certain age group, really. Certainly with these books, I felt like they would be solidly middle grade. in terms of the setting, starting with Coles Book Arcade. It was such a kid-friendly place that I thought it had to be a middle grade novel. Previously, I did a high fantasy manuscript that's not published. That had to be a YA novel because it was, you know, darker and it had a big dramatic romance and stuff. I wouldn't rule out writing for adults. I do enjoy writing for kids. They respond with such passion to the stories that they love. But yeah, if I had a concept that I thought was solidly an adult book, I would do it. I'm a bit intimidated by the seriousness of books, if I'm honest. I don't know if I would ever do, like, no, what I mean is it would almost certainly be fantasy or sci-fi because those are what I always like to write. So, yeah, and I've, you know, occasionally I get an idea just from reading some science news or something like that where I think, oh, that's an interesting idea for a story. So, yeah, if I came up with a concept that I thought was solidly an adult story and concept, I'd probably do it. But, yeah, it just depends on what the idea is and who it's suitable for.
Yeah. I mean, it must be quite a marked difference between the two styles of writing. I think that would be quite exciting to move in another kind of almost a different medium in a way. So the clues
withstand that different, but I've got a friend who says that my writing always sounds like me. So yeah, I'd like to think it would be a bit like the difference between the Tiffany Aching books and the rest of the Discworld books. I'm a big fan of Terry Pratchett. I like to think that the difference between my children's books and adult books, should I write any adult books ever, would be like that. But I don't know. I won't know until I do it, I guess.
The clue-solving and riddle-solving aspect of the novel was great fun, and I think that's a great example of your use of language and how, you know, language for itself can just be fun. Did they take you a while to write, and how did you kind of go about them? Because I just thought they were a great addition to the text.
Oh, thank you so much. I knew from the beginning that I'd have to put puzzles in these stories because Mr. Coles' books, the real Edward Coles' books, are just full of puzzles. They've entertained Australian children for hours, not necessarily in this century, although I hope that they are coming back to doing that. But I knew I'd have to do puzzles from the beginning. I also found out pretty quickly that I wouldn't be able to use those puzzles as they appear in Coles' books because times have changed and language has changed. And even the concepts that we recognize every day have changed. So I knew I'd have to make up some of the puzzles. Each of them took me hours and sometimes days. There are puzzles that have been cut from the story and I had to write new ones. And that goes for both books and that also goes for the third one. For instance, I won't spoil it, but there's a riddle about an animal in The Bookseller's Apprentice. And it certainly doesn't appear in Cole's books, but it was nevertheless inspired by them. The first version of that riddle was about a lizard. And then I decided that the lizard wasn't distinctive enough and I had to choose a different animal. And I was having so much trouble coming up with it. But again, Mr. Cole helped me out because I was flipping through Cole's Funny Picture Book and I came across a section about Australian wildlife in which a description of a certain animal, which, I mean, it was very colonial because it compared this animal to all kinds of European animals. But I was like, I can work with this description where he said it's got a face like a this and a body like a that, and it swims like a this and it makes a noise like a that. So, most of them are in some way inspired by Carl, but written by me, which takes hours, and I spend so much time I always have a thesaurus tab open and a writing dictionary tab open, and I will move words around very exactingly. If I can't find a word that rhymes, if I can't find a good rhyme, I change the whole line, which makes it very frustrating for me to read some picture books that are written in verse where I can tell that the author's just chosen a word because it rhymes. I get very with that. But I do enjoy playing with language, and I do put a lot of care into those riddles. So I'm glad they were fun. A lot of people tell me they can't actually solve them. they are fun, but I put a lot of work into them. And I certainly can't just copy and paste them from Cole.
Yeah. Okay, just a couple of quickies to close up. Who was your favourite CYA character when you were growing up and why?
Oh, there are quite a few.
Just the one.
I did really enjoy, they are technically two parts of the same person. So Lara Pantelimon from His Dark Materials, those became my favourite books when I was in upper primary school. And they were, in fact, I think they might have affected the way that I write a lot, because Bill Pullman certainly didn't shy away from tough vocabulary and challenging concepts. And I really liked Lyra's ferocity, and how she was absolutely not perfect, but she was still the hero.
And you've touched on this a little bit. What are you working on now, and where what's happening now?
The third book in the Greatest Bookshop trilogy.
And is that another prequel, or is that...
No.
It's a sequel.
It's a sequel. So it's 1895 when the Cole siblings from the Greatest Bookshop are 2 years older, and Billy and Kezia from The Bookseller's Apprentice are in their mid-30s. And it's called The Lost Book of Magic, and one of the big elements in it is the depression of the 1890s in Melbourne. Readers may feel that it's familiar. They have a cost of living crisis. There are issues with the climate. There's outbreaks of disease. Not that that features much in the story. It's a very dramatic time to be alive. It's a very dramatic book. are more riddles. We see the Obscura Smith again. That will be out in October, The Lost Book of Magic.
Lovely. So you won the 2023 ARA Historical Novel Prize, the CYA category. What did winning that prize mean to you?
It was so amazing. Winning it was a fantastic accolade, because, sometimes I feel like my books are just silly little things, but it was incredibly meaningful in that way. But the actual prize was extremely meaningful as well, because I write full time, if I didn't, I'd have to go back to teaching. Winning that prize enabled me to plan another whole year of full-time writing, which was just wonderful. It's a really great recognition of how much research and how much history goes into these books, even though they are fantasy books. I was just thrilled and humbled and delighted, and it was one of the biggest highlights of my career.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
that's excellent. So to end up today, do you have a riddle for us?
I don't. Directly from Cole, actually, and this is rare in Cole because you'll actually understand every word of it. He often mentions things like warming pans, which we don't have anymore, or, you know, certain varieties of apple that have gone out of favour. But this one should make sense to everyone in the 21st century as much as it did in the 19th. I'm seen in the moon, but not in the sun. I'm put in a pistol, but not in a gun. I'm found in a fork, but not in a knife. I belong to the parson, but not to his wife. I go with the rogue, but not with the thief. I'm seen in a book, but not in a leaf. I stay in a town, but not in the street. I go with your toes, but not with your feet. Would you like me to say what the answer is?
Well, maybe you should, or we're going to have complaints, aren't we?
Oh, okay. So the answer is the letter O. The word moon, pistol, fork, yeah. Arson, robe, book, town, and toes.
Very good. Well done. Well, congratulations with your writing, and I've enjoyed our conversation this morning. It's been fun. So.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.